Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
And I said, I want to win the league, but I want to win it better. You can understand that, can't you?
Yes.
Good lad.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
The plight of the sports fan aged somewhere in the mid to late 30s bracket. It's something I don't think gets enough airtime, to be honest, which is why I feel the need to bring it up on today's Irish Times Second Captain's podcast. You know exactly what I'm talking about, Murph, and to a much greater extent, Ken.
Forgotten men and women.
Early 30s.
I've forgotten long enough.
You hit a certain age, you suddenly start being reminded on an almost daily basis of, well, your lost youth, I guess. The sports people who were always in or around the same age as you growing up have all retired. Damn you, Steven Gerrard. Another link severed. Why couldn't he just hang on one more year?
Yeah.
My brother's the same age as Ryan Giggs, so he played this game for a lot longer than other people would have.
Yeah.
The footballers in the ones to watch articles start being born in a different millennium to you. It used to be that like 1991 date of birth would make me go, oh my God, I'm so old.
Yeah.
Now it's 2001.
Yes.
That's pretty scary. And even some of the biggest stars in world sport here, Simone Biles of this world, were born around the time you were thinking about how hard you're going to study for the Leaving Cert the following year. That kind of stuff. You know, it's easy to feel old watching sport now. That's all I'm saying. But not today, Ken. Not today. Because today, thanks to the Australian Open Tennis, it's a day for the old codgers. Roger Federer, 35 years of age, which stood a ferocious fight back from Stan Wawrinka to reach a men's final. Serena Williams, 35 also, is through to the women's final, where she can break Steffi Graf's record for Grand Slam titles in the Open era. Standing in her way, big sis Venus, 36. At 36 years old, she's through to the final in Melbourne for the first time in 14 years. So to all you old-timers listening, none of this actually makes us any younger, nor does it make us feel any younger. Oh, I forgot where I was going with this. I've got no uplifting message at the end.
It doesn't make us feel any better, really. Well, does it make us feel better?
Well, I mean, it's any one of those stories by themselves, any one of the three tennis stories you talked about would be heartening. But instead, I'm just worried about the future of tennis. What's happening there?
It's up to the young guns.
Has there been anyone born in the 90s that, you know, is
plays
any good at
the
tennis?
Sport.
Yeah.
Yeah. What age is Andy Murray? He must be 30-ish.
I'm going to say Andy Murray's 29, Ken. And Murph is furiously Googling it as we speak.
You're correct, Owen.
Is he 29? Which would make him around the same. Djokovic is around the same age. Djokovic could be 30.
Yeah.
Djokovic is 29 years old as well.
They're both 20. Yeah, they came up together through the junior ranks.
I would have thought the new Djokovic should have emerged by now.
Or there should be somebody in the 32, 33-year-old bracket in there. You know?
That's Nadal.
Well, Nadal's only 30. Nadal's younger than you would think. It's just he hasn't been around very much lately with all the injuries. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so he is.
Next up for Federer in the final, it's either Grigor Dimitrov, who could be the young gunslinger ready to take over. They call him the new Federer. Or Rafael Nadal, who is still there.
Positively sprightly at just 30 years of age in Australia this year.
So here's Federer talking to Jim Courier on TV post-match.
Let's talk about your greatest rival in your career, Rafael Nadal, and what he's meant to you. And just look into that matchup and give us a little preview of how you'd be looking forward to that match.
Yeah, it's real now. I can really actually talk about playing a finals for the first time. I've been dodging that bullet, you know, for the last sort of days now, not talking about the next round and the next round, but this is the last one. So I'll leave it all out here in Australia. And if I can't walk for another 5 months, that's okay. So I'll give it all I have. Rafael's definitely presented me with the biggest challenge in the game. I think I played him too many times on clay early in my career, and I think that has something to do then the way I played him on different surfaces too. But I think this court allows me to play offensive. I mean, I'm probably his number one fan of Rafa. I think his game is just tremendous. He's an incredible competitor, and I'm happy we did have some epic battles over the years. And of course, it would be unreal to play here. I think both of us, we would have never thought that we were going to be here potentially playing in the finals, because I went to open his academy in Mallorca with him a few months back, and I told him, look, I wish we could do like a charity match or like a something, but I was on one leg, he had the wrist injury, and we were playing some mini tennis with some juniors, and we're like, that's the best we can do right now. A few months later, we're maybe going to be in the finals. I am, he maybe. So it's I think it's very special for both of us, this tournament already. So I just hope it's going to be a good match tomorrow.
Thank you. I just realized listening back there, I was watching it earlier on, I didn't pick it up at the time. That sounds like canned laughter. Mm-hmm. It's almost too perfect and too rounded a sound each time. But no, that's how the loving Melbourne fan base of Roger Federer reacted to his very upbeat post-match interview there.
He's such a classy
guy. That's the word I was thinking of. There's like a bit of class to Roger Federer, all right. By the way, I know that's a bit presumptuous that they were asking about Nadal. The previous question was about what happens if you're playing Dimitrov in the final. So it was almost like a bit of politeness from Courier, because everybody knows that people want it to be Nadal versus Federer. So he starts talking about Dimitrov, and great all-round game, amazing player, this, that, and the other. And he says, and whether it's him or Rafa in the final. And as soon as he mentioned Rafa, even in the question about Dimitrov, the fans went, "Ray!" having been deathly silent during his platitudes about the other potential opponents. So I think we all know what people want to happen there. Would you consider yourself a good loser, Ken?
Show me a good loser and I'll show you a loser on. That's what I always say.
Indeed. You guys don't even know it yet, but by the end of this podcast, you will come to understand that loser is not a dirty word, Murph. I don't know where that phrase first came from. Show me a good loser and I'll show you a loser. But it's going to be rebuffed.
I'm going to say Vince Lombardi or some other Republican from the 1940s.
It's going to be rebuffed today by Sam Wyman, who we've chatted to a few times this year in his role as digital editor at golfdigest.com. Sam, we spoke to him a good few times over last year or so, I should say. He's brought out a book called Win at Losing, in which he analyzes the phenomenon of losing, how to deal with it, and how to benefit in the long run. I should say. It turns out, for those people who are beaten by all those old tennis players today, don't worry, you will have another shot. And if you learn the right lessons, you can come back strong. There's something, I think that's something that Carl Frampton has yet to deal with in his career, actually, unbeaten in 23 fights. On Saturday night / Sunday morning in Las Vegas, he defends his WBA featherweight title belt against Leo Santa Cruz, who himself only tasted defeat for the first time ever when he lost the belt to Frampton last year. That was a win that really launched Frampton into the big time in the US. Got a whole load of awards and recognition on the back of it. And we're going to talk to Andy Lee to see if he can get it done again. You wanted to talk Frampton there, did you?
Well, no, just being announced as the Ring Fighter of the Year, it doesn't get any more prestigious than that. Mm. And it's the Ring magazine is for, you know, RC boxing fans who, you know, the discerning boxing fan.
Yeah, the idea behind, well, it's a magazine that's been around forever, the Bible of boxing, all that kind of stuff. But also, because boxing is such a fractured sport and you always have more than one champion, and sometimes at least four champions in a weight division at any one time, the Ring magazine is often looked at as the one that can cut through the bullshit and tell you who's actually best.
Yeah, in the absence of the sport actually devising a system whereby the best fighters fight each other and then you can name the best fighter, the Ring magazine fighter of the year is about as clear cut as it gets in the boxing
and that's fighter of the year overall the divisions. That's the point of that. What I like about the fight this weekend is it is two of the best in the division fighting each other, and fighting each other for a second time, which you really don't see as much. That used to be the standard practice, but not so much. We really are sounding like old guys. Gotta stop this now. Luke Jensen from ESPN, it was so much to talk to you about, Luke, with regards to the tennis over the last 24 hours or so. You must have been pretty excited with what you saw.
The only bad thing is, big here in the States, is you pull the all-nighters. I mean, if Federer closes this thing out in three sets, I get some sleep. But he draws it out to five sets. So I'm running on zero sleep right now But the women's side has been amazing. The old dogs in the fight. These 30-year-olds are just pulling through left and right. Not to mention the Bryan brothers in their late 30s. They're still in the doubles. They're in the finals. So it's been amazing, crazy stuff.
Yeah, crazy. Venus, 36 years of age. Serena, 35 years of age. Federer is 35. I'm just seeing BBC tweeting that he's the oldest man to reach a Grand Slam final, any Grand Slam final, since 1974. Yeah, it's almost counterintuitive. It should be a young man's game and a young woman's game, and to an extent it is, but these guys are still going.
Well, that was the great Australian Ken Rosewall, known as Muscles. He reached the finals of Wimbledon and then followed up with the finals of the U.S. Open, got thumped both times by young Jimmy Connors. But I think the one thing that Federer's been able to do is always think about big picture, long term. You know, what does this mean for his career? He could have come back in last year's U.S. Open, but instead he said, you know, what if I take 6 months off? And this doctor was like off the charts. But if you could give me 6 months right now to work on this leg, to rehab this knee, I could give you 3 more years of performance. And I think that kind of mindset helps the older player. What I'm worried about, though, he's gone some tough matches, 5 sets with Nishikori, earlier in the tournament. Then he goes 5 sets here. How much gas does he have left in the tank to play maybe his nemesis, Nadal? You know, maybe baby Fed, you know, Dimitrov. So it's going to be very tricky this final.
Luke, we were watching this match in the office and we were remarking how tennis is, the momentum is a big deal in all sports, but in tennis, it's incredible how it can switch a couple of times even within one set. Like, this had all the hallmarks of Stan Wawrinka, really dogged player, really top quality player. He had completely wrested the initiative from Federer. He looked like he was going to romp home. He was, you know, he's on break point a couple of times on Federer's serve in the fifth set, having come from 2 sets down. And out of nowhere, Federer switches and then crushes him for the rest of the match. How did he do it?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that in our game, you don't have on-court coaching like you have in other sports. It's closer to golf. Even boxing, in between rounds, you get your trainer, your cut man. That's a big difference. In tennis, there is some stuff where you look to your box, but you have to do it all on your own. And because of that, in my opinion, I played, you have these momentous, you know, shifts of momentum. Tides turn so quickly. And if you look at, you know, especially the way individuals deal with pressure, because it's an individual game, you can't substitute out. You can't put fresh legs in. It's all on you. And, you know, Wawrinka is so, you know, kind of locked into what Federer kind of does, because he was like the understudy to Federer all these years, knows everything about Federer, practiced with him, ate with him, did all these different things with him. So he knows when Federer is like starting to come down a little bit. And after 2 sets to love, the pressure shifted again, right to Roger Federer, and Wawrinka started hitting freer, relaxed, going for his shots. They get into a 5th set. And you really have to look at the nuances. When I saw Roger Federer take that injury timeout to go in to get his leg wrapped, the upper thigh, upper groin, somewhere in there. It wasn't very specific, but it was up high, so he had to go off the court and get it addressed. That was kind of the reset Federer needed, just a little extra rest to put him over the top.
Yeah, and it was interesting. He was quite funny afterwards when he was asked about it by Jim Courier. He said, well, look, you know, I don't usually go in for these injury breaks, but pretty much everyone else does it, so why can't I do it from time to time? And it seemed to work, yeah.
He'll be questioned on that. A lot of critics will like say, man, you've always been against this. You've always been critical of players to do that. To me, I don't think that's out of bounds. I see it all the time. These players are running miles upon miles on these courts. They're giving you 3-4+ hours. They're just laying it out there, their guts and their grit. A couple of moments here and there in between sets is not a big deal to me. I don't think it was a massive, you know, big difference. Wawrinka had the same amount of break, and I just think that it was Federer was too good in the 5 sets.
Do you feel a little bit sorry in this scenario now over the next 24 hours for Grigor Dimitrov? I don't think anybody outside the Dimitrov family circle and coaching circle wants anything other than a Nadal-Federer final. I guess that could be good motivation for Dimitrov, though.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, baby Fed's really playing on house money. He wins the warm-up tournament in Sydney. He's coming in really hot. He's starting to come into his own. This is a guy who was given the big contracts and the big dollars. He dated the really hot chicks like Sharapova. Everything was like kind of handed to him. But his game suffered. He was distracted by all the goodies and all the candy. And now he's come to realize he's got to play ball. He's got to get in there and train and focus and do those little things. And you can see it's really paid off for him. I think Nadal's going to get him, and I think we're going to have a classic matchup. Nadal's going to win probably four sets over Dimitrov. And my heart wants Federer to win this, and my heart wants Federer to beat Nadal.
Just the last one, if we're praising Federer so highly as we should for making it into a final again, what about Venus Williams, who has had the added complication of this Sjogren syndrome over the last number of years, which has obviously affected her career? How much respect do you have for her for making it through to face her sister once again? First time in 8 years in a major final.
In a major final, how about that? I mean, I couldn't believe she was still playing. I mean, she's got so many things going on off the court. She's got her own clothing line, designer. She's got an interior design company. She's got so many things bopping around that can keep her busy in life and keep her going. But the tennis was always the one thing where she stayed on the court, took some losses, just kept going, dealing with those physical situations. I have so much, you know, just pride, so much respect for her sticking it out. And you know what? Serena better be careful, because Venus isn't going to roll over. Venus is going to hit some big serves, some big shots. She's going to have to. But this is not going to be an easy rollover for Serena. Serena doesn't like playing in these pressure situations. We've seen it the last couple of years where she's kind of, you know, stumbled at the finish line. You know, you got to watch Venus, who's going for the throat on this one.
It's a hell of a tournament so far. Listen, Luke Jensen, ESPN, great to talk to you. Glad you're enjoying it.
Owen, you're amazing.
Owen, you're amazing. Owen, you're amazing.
I'm telling you, I haven't talked to Luke in too long. You can feel pretty good about yourself after a chat with Luke.
Owen, you're... Is this how we're going to... Instead of the thank yous at the end of the show, I should do Owen, you're amazing, Ken. You're amazing.
Well, maybe it is a nice habit to get into, just to finish your conversations by saying that sort of thing.
Yeah, instead of goodbye, you're amazing. Isn't that what Donald Trump does?
Yes.
I was just thinking of it.
Something like that.
You're the best. You're the greatest.
You're the greatest, yeah.
Every time he hung up the phone with
regardless of who
Tony
it was.
Schwartz.
Yeah.
You're the greatest.
Yeah, but maybe it works. I mean, to be fair, Owen was glowing with happiness and we both felt envious.
Yeah.
So it's like, I mean, I remember...
In the days before Emoji,
Owen Coyle would send a text message. Sometimes you'd ring your text on call and say, Owen, would you mind, are you free? Maybe take a call, have a chat about...
Former Ireland International.
This or that. And he would send back a message saying, no, actually, not free, but happy to talk some other time. And then a little smiley face with it made of a colon and smiling bracket. Mm-hmm. And I always thought I always felt oddly affected by those messages. Mm. I thought... Yeah.
What a bloody nice bloke.
What
a lovely man.
Obviously never talks to us, but...
But just put in that little smiley face, and I thought, okay. So, I think it's generally more positivity is good. Let's not be afraid to tell each other how great we are.
Carl Frampton's fans have been streaming into Las Vegas over the last 24 hours or so. There's talk of about 5,000 of them being there on Saturday night for the rematch with Leo Santa Cruz, which means you can expect plenty of Frampton's on fire. Santa Cruz is terrified, chance. Which they belted out after the last fight. But can he back up last year's win, which earned Frampton the Ring Magazine Fight of the Year award? Andy Lee's going to tell us. Andy, how's the form?
Good, Don. Thanks very much.
I saw you were chatting to Michael Foley in the Sunday Times, and you brought up the good wall choice that you made on Second Captain's Live a couple of years back, where you put Frampton into the top 10 Irish sports people of all time. Much to my bemusement, I must say, I didn't doubt that Frampton was a high-level fighter, but I didn't realise that he would be in that sort of a bracket. But I'd say you're feeling pretty smug about that choice now.
Yeah, I feel pretty good about it now. Yeah. Ring Fight of the Year is the only ever Irish fighter to get it, and it's a real accolade, you know. It's the equivalent of an Oscar, you know, winning an Oscar for Best Actor. It's a fantastic achievement, and it's fully deserved. You know what he did last year, he's done previously. But yeah.
Can you put that into context? What he did last year by stepping up in weight and knocking Santa Cruz off his perch.
Not only that, beating his biggest rival at super bantamweight, Scott Quigg, in a fight that was much hype and built over the years, performing, you know, on the, which, you know, would have been the biggest and most pressured stage, beating him convincingly, and then stepping up in weight and fighting one of the best, like, established champions at featherweight, becoming a two-weight world champion, and doing it with, you know, a very pleasing style and crowd-pleasing style, and, you know, technically a very, you know, very good boy of boxing. So it's fully deserved. There was no one who's done what he did last year in terms of winning two world titles at different weights. And the fact that he's going back to fight Santa Cruz again should be commended again. It's another achievement, because it's very rare in this day and age where you have fighters who are willing to test himself every fight. You know, he'd be forgiven for taking an easier fight, maybe defending his belt at home and then going again. But he's stepping right back in there with Santa Cruz, and it's not something that happens, you know, very often in boxing these days.
Yeah, the idea of a rematch is, it's appealing in a lot of ways, not the least of which is boxing is a sport that used to have this to a greater extent. It used to have rivalries, used to have these great fighters fighting each other. Not just, we all know that, you know, fighters can avoid fighting the other best guys, but when you've already fought against somebody as good as Santa Cruz, to fight him again, it's kind of fascinating to see what happens. It's a rivalry essentially being built here.
Yeah, and it has all the ingredients for, like, I don't want to say, but if you know, it has all the ingredients for a trilogy, you know. They were so evenly matched. Well, I thought Frampton won the second fight convincingly, even though one judge had a majority, you know, in favor of Santa Cruz, which I don't know what he was looking at the first fight. But I believe both fighters will be improved in this fight. They've had the experience of fighting each other once already. They'll know what to look for. And then they will have, you know, they will be trying to implement a new game plan and try to correct the mistakes that they've made. So both fighters have, you know, have something to motivate themselves. It's Frampton's second fight at the weight. He's already beaten Santa Cruz, so he has that edge on him. And he's going to be more comfortable at the weight, where Santa Cruz has the motivation of having lost, wanting to prove himself. And with the fight being on the West Coast, I think that's a little, even though it might be nullified a bit by the 5,000 Frampton fans travelling, I'm sure they'll be well heard in the arena. The fact that it's on the West Coast and there's a couple of Mexican fighters fighting on the undercard, it'll be a strong Mexican crowd, I believe. And so, you know, it's an intriguing fight, as well as the styles, how they match up. Santa Cruz is a pressure fighter, but he's also the taller fighter, and he had his best moments, I thought, in the first fight when he stood at range and punched from distance, not overcrowded his work by getting too close. So it's an intriguing fight, you know, which way, how you set out your stall for the second fight, and what tactics do you try to employ? Do you anticipate the fighters changing their game plans? It's intriguing to see how it will unfold.
Well, Frampton seems to think, and Shane McGuigan seems to think that Santa Cruz won't change anything because he can't change anything, that he only fights one way. He's, as you say, a pressure fighter. He throws over 1,000 punches in a fight, and that's all he can do. But you seem to be suggesting that actually maybe he can switch it up a bit. Maybe he can stay at range and change things up and maybe make Frampton come to him a bit.
I've just been listening to a few things he was saying in the build-up to the fight, and it seems to be that he's still going to throw the volume of punches. He's not going to be almost like a fancy damn boxer on the outside, you know, moving around. But I think what he's been saying is that his plan is to hold his feet, not to be walking in almost, you know, to take two punches to land three, that kind of a style, where he's going to hold his feet and use his height and his arms and reach advantage, you know. So it'll be interesting. But Frampton, you know, even if he does that, it still might not be enough, because Frampton is a very intelligent fighter, very well balanced, very precise, and has good power too. He hurt Santa Cruz in the first fight, early in the fight, and I think it took Santa Cruz a while to overcome that. You know, it took him 3 or 4 rounds before he really got back into the fight. So Frampton knows he can hurt him, and it's interesting that they've been talking about going for the knockout a little bit, and it's a big statement to make. And if he does it, it would be, he'll have made a big statement.
Yeah, there's an interview that Frampton did with Don McRae, and he said it's just about being smarter this time, hitting him clean and putting more emphasis into those shots. If I do that, I think I can effing knock him out. I really do. Which by that, like by Frampton standards, that's pretty much trash talk right there. Yeah, he's not really a big trash talker.
It's a bold statement, and his confidence is high, and he believes it. And it wouldn't surprise me if he did. You know, that's how good he is. That's how highly I rate him. So, you know, it's just great to see. And like I said, I feel very much like I told you so. I told you so moment. So it's good.
Just on the emotional side of things, away from the tactics of it. One thing that would worry me slightly is this issue around Santa Cruz's dad, who's in his corner, has always been in his corner, but was receiving treatment for cancer the last time. So he wasn't there. He's getting better, thankfully. And he is going to be around this time of things. This time, that would lead you to believe that Santa Cruz, there's no way that kind of stuff can't affect you going into a fight. And he's got to be in a better frame of mind this time around. So maybe the Santa Cruz that Frampton saw last time wasn't actually him at 100% emotionally.
Exactly. And, you know, everything, it's well noted that he had a disruptive camp, that his dad wasn't involved, that he was receiving chemo and that his brother was training him. And then his dad traveled to New York the week of the fight and tried to change the game plan almost, and instructed his son to do something different that they hadn't planned in camp. And then Santa Cruz has said that he found himself caught in between two styles of fighting, not knowing which way to follow his father or his brother.
That's a nightmare. That sounds like the worst possible preparation.
And I've said this before, and it's the truest word, like the truest thing I can think of. But whatever you're going through, and boxing is when you see a fight, you see the two people at that, you know, in that truest form, because what you've experienced in the build up to that fight and what you've gone through in the training camp up to that fight, it all shows itself in the performance. And saying that, if he did have a troubled training camp and had these problems going into it, he still performed pretty well, you know. It was a close fight, and it was arguably one of the fights of the year. It's another reason why we can expect a better Leo Santa Cruz. The fact that he's had a more peaceful training camp, and that he'll have prepared a lot better, and he'll have one strict vision of what he's going to do, and one clear instruction what he's going to do in the fight.
But having said all that, you think Frampton will do it again and will really, I mean, he's been getting a lot of attention stateside and around the boxing world. If he backs this up, there's a certain sort of aura around a fighter who can do that, who can give the rematch and then win the rematch. You think he's going to do it?
I still favour Frampton. Even though I think it'll be a better fight, I think Frampton has too many aspects to his game. He can fight going forward. He can slug it out if he has to. But if he chooses to box, which I think he will, I think he'll win pretty convincingly. And it's still going to be tough. Believe me, I think it'll be a tough fight. But I can see Frampton winning a pretty good wide decision.
He stays on the good wall for you. Listen, Andy, great stuff. Okay. Thanks a million.
Thanks, Owen. Thanks very much. Won't you bring back all those colors to my dreams? Don't you remember? Float like a butterfly and sting like a bee. Who give a damn about the money, being shot, take the title, take it all, and go to jail tomorrow?
This chump has got everybody scared. Scared of what?
You told him I don't have nothing but a prayer. Well, chump, all I need is a prayer, because if that prayer reached the right man, not only will George Foreman fall, but mountains will fall.
Oh, my God, he's won the title back at 32!
This brash young boxer is something to see, and the heavyweight championship is his destiny.
You saw him on television, there was no one more beautiful. You saw him walking down the street, he was a beautiful thing to see. He moved around the ring, he had style and class, he was tall and good-looking. Everything you'd want from a boxer, wrestler, football player, And to be honest with you, he belonged to the arts because he had poem, poetry. He had it all. Sugar man met a false friend
on a lonely, dusty road. Specimen, fighting machine. You know, he was handsome, he was articulate, he was funny, charismatic, and was whooping ass too.
The good news, if you want to watch the fight, is that it is on Sky Sports 1, as opposed to Sky Box Office or anything like that. So if you already have Sky, you can... I was about to say it's on terrestrial TV. Sky's not quite that, but it sometimes feels like it. You don't have to pay any extra money on top of the money you already pay extra to have a Sky Sports subscription. So you can watch that. It will be the middle of the night. It will be very late Vegas time. So whatever way you do these things, I know you go to bed early, set an alarm, get up. People often ask for exact times. I don't know, but I... if it's Vegas, it's going to be particularly late. The ring walks.
If you do stay up rather than go to bed, and you fancy, you know, a few beers, maybe to just keep you.
Can't do it anymore, Murph. I'm too old.
Just regulate your drinking. I'm here with a lot of people. It has its pluses and also its minuses. I tried to watch it.
You can be sure that man will be in Vegas and will not be watching. We'll not be needing to watch it on TV or anything like that.
Yeah, Sky's coverage of it.
Ken, that man is also a keen football fan, so I'm sure if he's listening, he'd like to know what's in the Irish Times Second Captain's football podcast today.
They have asked for that, really.
Yeah, you can laugh. It was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I'd like to stay alive for 6 days.
I'm going to need it there.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down Swanfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawnee man?
Well, we talked a little bit about what's happened to Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool Football Club revolution. Are the believers becoming doubters? And we talked also about the Africa Cup of Nations with Jonathan Wilson, who is over in Gabon reporting for everybody.
Yeah, everybody really wants nice to talk to him about some nice stories from Gabon, from the Africa Cup of Nations. From Jonathan, you heard Luke Jensen earlier praising Venus Williams for her ability to deal with the setbacks that she's faced in her career and bounce back to make it into another Grand Slam final. I'd imagine that sort of resilience would impress our next guest, Sam Wineman. We've spoken to Sam plenty of times in his day job at golfdigest.com, but he recently brought out a fascinating new book called Win at Losing: How Our Biggest Setbacks Can Lead to Our Greatest Gains. Sam, great to have you on the show as always.
Oh, my pleasure, Owen. Thank you.
I think the Venus example is quite apt at the moment, because I believe the genesis of this book came from a tennis match you attended, albeit at a slightly lower level.
It's just a hair lower, but the parallels are there. Yes, my book started with my son, a 10-year-old club tennis match, losing a match and having a sort of meltdown and swearing off tennis forever. But from that came this realization to me that, you know, not only do my kids need to learn to lose, but people in general need to understand that losing has really good benefits and, you know, can really shape us in positive ways. And so I went down this road of talking to people in all sorts of walks of life, sports, but also politics and business, about how various pockets of adversity help them.
Slight digression, but is Charlie, young Charlie, a Roger or a Rafa man?
Well, very much a Rafa. In fact, he wears a headband in tribute to Rafa. So
right.
It's not even a question.
Yeah. So you'll probably find a way to watch it tomorrow, I'd imagine, semi-final. So you say this, okay, I mean, obviously you're supposed to lose graciously. That's what you're taught, either formally or informally growing up. You know, you should try not to be a bad loser. You should try not to have tantrums, which is pretty hard to do. Are you talking about losing graciously, or are you talking about learning something from your defeats so that you can improve as a sports person or as a businessman or whatever it might be?
Yeah, I'm talking about both, but more the latter. Certainly, you know, sportsmanship and being gracious and dignified in these moments is important. I don't mean to undercut that, but you know, in my mind, especially, I'm a terrible loser in the moment, you know, as Charlie is, in terms of, I think, you know, we can get emotional and be upset about losing. And I'm not necessarily saying that's a bad thing. What I am saying is that once you have that moment and it passes, what are you doing next to learn and grow from it? And it's not always linear. There's not always like this great revelation, but it's just like being open to the idea that, okay, this is probably something that can help, and it's probably exposing something that I need to work on, and how can I capitalize on that? And so Yes, you know, I don't advocate throwing rackets or banging your stick or whatever the instrument is, but I do feel like you're allowed to be emotional provided you are just being constructive about it as well.
The sort of people you talk to, have they all come full circle? Are they at a distance from their failures, if you know what I mean? Are you talking to people who learned from their failures, became successful and can now deal with it? Or was there anybody who is still in the throes of not having quite come to terms with whatever they failed at? Or lost out,
yeah,
I should say.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, it's like I make the point that it's not just always this great redemption where, you know, person X has a failure, learns from mistakes, and goes on to have this great success. Some people never recovered. Like one of the examples, of course, is Michael Dukakis, who ran for president in 1988 and lost the election, didn't run for public office again. So by that measure, he's not someone who can say, oh, I learned from the lessons of my first presidential defeat to go on to apply them to winning the presidency back or winning whatever. But he was someone who sort of learned to accept defeat and it helped him as a person. So and he did grow from it and became, you know, philosophical about what went wrong and why he lost. So I you know, he's someone, I guess you could say, still dealing with it to an extent. I mean, is it funny enough that when I first handed in the draft of the book, I talked about Jordan Spieth. I didn't talk about Jordan Spieth, I should say. I had written this chapter about Greg Norman losing the Masters in 1996, and then you and I spoke shortly thereafter.
Yeah.
That, you know, Jordan Spieth had this colossal meltdown in the Masters, and so I felt compelled to include him in the book. And so, you know, he's a bit of an open book in terms of how he's going to respond to it, but you know, by all indications, he's someone who's going to look at what happened and try to learn from it. But who knows? Maybe Jordan Spieth never wins a major again or never contends in a major again. Probably not. But you know, he's someone where he hasn't had the time to, you know, apply the proper perspective to what happened to him.
Yeah, that was when we first touched on this book. Actually, you told us that you were in the middle of writing it at the time, and mm-hmm. you had interviewed Greg Norman. What sort of perspective did Norman have on his fairly spectacular blowouts at a couple of major events, the Masters in particular?
Yeah, well, in his case, again, he's kind of like Dukakis in the sense that he never won another major or, you know, never really reached the same heights as a player. But for him, it shaped him in terms of it humbled him and sort of made him a much more accessible person and businessman. I mean, here was a guy who was vastly successful by most accounts, you know, flew his plane to tournaments and, you know, had various homes around the world. But he wasn't really someone who people could connect with on a human level just because he seemed so larger than life. And then he has this amazing collapse in the Masters. You know, he had other collapses in tournaments, but this was sort of the most dramatic because he had a six-shot lead and shot 76, and it sort of carried out over the course of an afternoon. And he handled it in such an admirable and gracious way and owned up to the mistakes. And I feel like people really connected with him in ways that they hadn't before, and he recognized that. But then also, you know, in this sort of second act he's had as a businessman and executive, he's a big proponent of learning from your failures and what you can apply to them. And he's had a bunch in the business world as well, and I think he sees that has real benefits.
How proactive? You got to be careful, I guess, that you're not wallowing in self-pity when you lose a big event. You have to analyze. There's a couple of traps you could fall into, I guess. You could get too wrapped up in why you lost and the reasons why you lost and overanalyze somewhat. Or also you can say, right, I've thought about it, I've talked about it, and
right.
You can almost convince yourself that you've dealt with it when you haven't.
Yeah, this is a very tricky area, and you're dead on. It's kind of a tight balance that you walk because there is a point where you're dwelling too long on it and you're obsessing over it, and that's not very productive. And maybe you're beating yourself up for something that's not entirely your fault. Like there's a part of that as well, which is you've had a loss, and there could be a whole series of events that led to it that might be outside your control. So in some way, you have to also be able to give yourself a pass or forgive yourself. But there's also this real risk of sort of glossing over it and not dealing with it and just kind of skipping ahead. And, you know, that's a huge miss as well because you're failing to see, you know, what you can take away from it. So, you know, the sort of common ingredient you need to have is real honesty. Like when you go through some type of loss, is having a real solid 360-degree sense of what happened so that you know how to sort of compartmentalize it.
It's interesting on the Federer, in the tennis example, Federer was talking to Jim Courier on Australian TV afterwards, and he was asked about Nadal, obviously, and the possibility of them playing in another final. And I would have loved for this part of the conversation to for it to be a different forum where you could actually really drill down into Federer's thoughts, because he said something really interesting. He made the point that Nadal, he's obviously had a lot of matches against Nadal and lost quite a lot of matches against Nadal. And he says because he played him quite a lot on clay early in his career, or certainly earlier in Nadal's career, and lost those matches, that seeped into how he thought about how he was supposed to play him on other surfaces and possibly negatively affected him there. It was just an interesting comment, and that's clearly somebody, Federer is obviously somebody who loses well in the sense that he thinks about what he could do, but even somebody at that vaunted status can get too wrapped up in what an opponent is doing.
Well, that's really interesting. It's sort of something I talk about in the book. It's something called a negativity bias, which is you have this, you know, there's like a part of our brains are wired to focus a little bit on the negative, and sometimes it can be really counterproductive, because, you know, like the negativity bias is something that roots back to when we were, you know, cavemen basically, and we had to know, you know, don't eat this plant because it might poison you and die. So you have this sort of, your brain is trained to focus on things to more mostly as a protective measure. And so, but it seeps into how we play sports, because you're like, oh, this is a guy I always lose to. And he kind of triggers all these thoughts about how he always loses to him. So you're right. Even though he lost to him a bunch in clay and had a pretty good record, a relatively good record against Federer or against Nadal on other surfaces, it might weigh on his psyche in a negative way. And so how do you learn, like, how do you extract the positives from those experiences and like what you can learn from it without immediately submitting to the fact that, oh, I'm definitely going to lose because this guy just has my number. It's again, very tricky balance.
You mentioned Michael Dukakis earlier, Sam. He lost the 1988 presidential election, lost heavily to George H.W. Bush, having led in the polls early on. So I would imagine he's one of the few people in the world who can truly have an idea what Hillary Clinton had to go through on Inauguration Day, grinding her way through the inauguration of President Trump there and trying to do her civic duty and pull it off with a smile on her face. Did you get those parallels? You know, when Hillary started unraveling, did you start feeling, Jesus, this is very similar to what I was talking to Dukakis about?
I mean, there's so many things that are similar. Obviously, this is such a unique situation on so many levels with what we're dealing with in this country. But there are some parallels in terms of the individual, which is, here is someone who was ahead in the polls, seemed to be poised to win, lost, and, you know, ended up losing big, probably won't run for public office again. You never know, but probably won't. And so now has to sort of reconcile how she feels about herself, about her career, what she does the rest of her life. I think the biggest, you know, there's the individual message to Hillary Clinton, someone, which is that Michael Dukakis lost the presidency, you know, 3 decades ago, and has had a very productive life in public service since then, you know, connecting with people. He's been a professor and been an advocate for various social causes. So he's, you know, done a lot of good things in the years since he was president. So Hillary Clinton should realize that's very applicable to her as well. And then there's sort of this macro look at, like, how do we as a country who did not support Donald Trump deal with the fact that our guy did not win and he's our president? Well, you know, you make the case that, you know, Michael Dukakis' loss paved the way for Bill Clinton to win 4 years later. And, you know, it sort of strengthened the Democratic base. So there's all kinds of parallels to draw from that, and to look at that as an example of how things might play out from here.
Were there people who didn't want to talk? Did you contact many people who said, here, listen, I don't want to go back into the worst part of my life or my career for you to get an interesting book?
Yeah, totally. They were. And I would say that if that was the case, then they were probably not the best people to talk to me anyway. I mean, they would have been good as a sort of counterpoint to this whole premise. But what I was looking for was people who could recognize, you know, my premise that losing has value in their lives and was a positive thing. Not to say they enjoyed it, but that they saw that it shaped them in a positive way. So if you had people, and I had a couple, like, you know, athletes, like, I don't want to talk about that, I didn't lose, and it was ridiculous, that those people don't necessarily get it and aren't really going to be instructive for other people to learn from. So that was one part of it. The other part is, like, you know, there's just people I tried to get and, like, couldn't get him, you know, like Bill Buckner, baseball player you may be familiar with, like, had this colossal mistake in the World Series in 1986. I tried to track him down, I thought he'd be great, and I just never heard back from him, which is sort of the life we lead as a journalist. Sometimes people just don't want to talk to you.
Yeah, it's true enough. Well, listen, Sam Wyman, the book is called Win at Losing. We recommend people check it out for themselves. Amazon.com, I presume, would be the best bet internationally?
Yes, you can get it at Amazon.com, or my website is samwyman.com. There's a lot of information there as well.
Perfect. I hope for the Wineman, for the sake of the Wineman household, that Rafa pulls through tomorrow anyway and has another shot at Roger. Listen, Sam, great stuff. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
second captain.
They're better at the internet than we are.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
Second captain.
I thought that.
Do you believe this? It's so unbelievable.
Second captain.
On the internet. I'm going to bomb the shit out of them. It's true. I don't care. I don't care. They've got to be stopped.
We did a piece on Monday's show about Donald Trump's friendship with Tom Brady, if you remember that one. Now, at the risk of offending one of our listeners, Damien Mallon, who tweeted me on Monday, 20 minutes of political debate before any actual sports analysis on the sports podcast yesterday. Sorry, not why I subscribed. At the risk of offending that gentleman. Seems like Brady, Kent, might have some competition as Trump's number one sports guy.
Yeah. well, it's hard to know who the number one is, but definitely Bernard Langer is up there.
How did Langer come into the conversation?
Well,
trending on Twitter nationally in the US yesterday.
Bernard Langer.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of people wondering, they've come to the seniors tour quite late, but welcome aboard all the new fans.
Ooh, his swing is looking good.
The New York Times reported that that when Donald Trump was speaking to House and Senate leaders in the state dining room, he said, I was told a story. He was complaining about voter fraud. You know, this thing. He claims that there was millions of people voted illegally for Hillary Clinton. And he says, I was told a story by the very famous golfer, Bernard Langer. Now, this is obviously, this is not like a covered, this is a kind of an off-the-record type of a meeting. You know, it's not like a media event. Mm. It's kind of a, you know.
Because he very ostentatiously brings Tom Brady's name up in public. This is more of a private meeting.
So three separate witnesses had told this story at the New York Times. In which, so he said that Bernard Langer told him that he was standing in a queue near a polling station in Florida where he lives on election day, queuing to vote. When suddenly he was informed by an official that he would not be able to vote. Now, ahead of and behind Mr. Langer were voters who did not look as if they should be allowed to vote.
Let that sink in there.
Mr. Trump said, according to the staff members. But they were nonetheless permitted to cast provisional ballots. The president threw out the names of Latin American countries the voters might have come from. Mr. Langer, whom he described as a supporter, left feeling frustrated, according to a version of events later contradicted by a White House official. The anecdote, the aide said, was greeted with silence. And Mr. Trump was prodded to change the subject by Ryan's previous White House chief of staff. So the issue with this is that Langer is in fact still a German. He's not. He is a German citizen who has permanent residency in the United States. So by law, he can't vote. You know, he has never voted. His daughter told the New York Times, he's a citizen of Germany. He's not a friend of President Trump's. I don't know why he would talk about him. Trump insists. He also mentioned in the I don't know if you saw his interview that he did yesterday, in which he advocated all kinds of things, like numerous war crimes and whatnot. But he said that in amongst all that, he said that he had got a standing ovation when he did this speech at the CIA. He said, I got a standing ovation. Now, ABC were apparently so confused by this that they just left it out altogether, but it is in their transcript, the transcript they produced of the entire interview. It was obviously a slightly edited version that they aired. But in the transcript, he said, you know, I spoke to the crowd. This is Trump talking to the CIA. I spoke to the crowd. I got a standing ovation. In fact, they said it was the biggest standing ovation since Peyton Manning had won the Super Bowl, and they said it was equal. I got a standing ovation. It lasted for a long period of time. I know when I do good speeches, I know when I do bad speeches. That speech was a total home run. They loved it. So I don't know. I guess it must have been Peyton Manning's Super Bowl win last year. Mm. He won last year with the Denver Broncos.
Yeah. The standing ovation is also up for debate, since he didn't actually ask them to sit down. So they actually were standing for the duration of his speech.
Apparently, they don't sit down unless the president explicitly instructs them, you can sit down
but
now.
Sorry, I don't even understand what he's comparing it to. What standing ovation did Peyton Manning get? When did he do a function afterwards? Owen, is he talking about the supporters at the
Owen, I really don't know. I don't know, Owen. And I don't know who they is. Was this the CIA who said that's the big, that's the biggest standing ovation since Peyton Manning won the Super Bowl?
We all watched it here in the bar, the CIA bar.
No, it appears to me as if Peyton Manning made an informal visit to the CIA, spoke to a number of people at the CIA
after winning the Super Bowl,
who gave him a standing ovation.
Okay.
Apparently, Peyton Manning is going to meet him in the next few days to talk about. I guess
Tom Brady's not going to like that.
Yeah, you know, maybe he's just playing them off against each other. What have you done for me lately, Tom Brady?
Bernard Langer's not going to like that. More to the point, the apple in his eye.
Bernard Langer just seems a little bit confused by everything that's going on and probably hoping not to be dragged into this arena again.
Langer's like, I just want to go and play some tournament that not many people will watch, but I will probably win about $500,000.
Bernard Langer told Donald Trump that he was surrounded by people who looked as though they shouldn't be allowed to vote as he was waiting to vote. He wasn't waiting to vote, and he apparently doesn't know him, and I don't know.
Well, yeah.
But why not just the name Bernard Langer? Why not just start talking about Bernard Langer all of a sudden?
Hmm. It seems almost too crazy to imagine such a story. And yet, Ken, and yet.
And yet.
Next week, Corey Pavin. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Owen.
Thanks very much, Kieran.
Owen, you're amazing. Ken, you're amazing.
Thank you, Kieran.
Listeners, you're all amazing, including you, Damien Mallon. I'm sorry for bringing politics back into a bit of... It's okay to branch out from time to time, Damien. Maybe 20 minutes, some could argue, too much. Who knows?
I understand that there is a very understandable urge to want to ignore all of this. An urge which maybe is going to become more and more overpowering as this goes on. But like at the moment, you know, it seems as though it's quite difficult to tear your eyes away from this unfolding train wreck that is the planet. So we may occasionally sprinkle references to this planetary train wreck.
What phone is that? That's the second time it's gone off. They never go home, those boys.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.